Okay, everybody. Well, welcome to the new and improved monthly meeting of the Alliance of Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. Sorry for my sense of humor this morning, but as many of you know, we encountered a technical difficulty today. Not quite sure what did happen, and we'll figure that out at a later time. But we wanted to go ahead and send out or get this meeting started. So thanks, many thanks to Roger Honeycutt, who in fact was the one who got us online here. Unfortunately, my Zoom account wasn't working for me and using my computer, but Roger was able to for him. So again, this is the monthly meeting of the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws, and we certainly welcome everybody here. Joining today, as always, is criminal defense attorney and AXL president, Chance Oberstein. Chance, would you like to say good morning?
Cheers.
Okay.
Good morning. Good morning, everybody.
Yeah. So we do have a whole lot of things to talk about today. And I know people are still joining us, and that's a good thing. And I believe Roger is admitting people into the meeting. We hope that we don't have any more technical difficulties, and we certainly appreciate your patience in dealing with the difficulties, including getting a brand new link this morning for joining the meeting. So one of the things that I sometimes forget to do until halfway through the meeting or later is to remind people of the website. So the Alliance's website is www.all4conso laws.org. So please join the website early and often. We put new articles on there almost every single day, and we have plenty and plenty of information for everybody. And I want you to know that I read those comments at least once a day, sometimes two or three times a day. And if I see something that needs correcting, or something that I can add to in a meaningful way, I do. I know I just did that this morning before the meeting. And so that's a really important way for registrants to ask a question. And when you ask a question that way on the website, just know that you're asking the question on behalf of a whole lot of other people who were thinking something similar, but hadn't gotten around to asking the question. So I do appreciate your asking questions on a right. So again, please join. So yes, we've got one of our board members, David, who's saying kudos to Roger. I certainly agree with you there, David. Roger, by the way, works on our website every single day. He's the one who posts most of the articles on the website. And then we do have a webmaster as well. His first name is Chuck. And between the two of them, they keep us up and running. We just had a presentation at the AXL board meeting on Thursday of this week, and Roger let us know about some changes to the website, which has actually made our website more robust. And so we now allow, it's easier for us to post things like videos and photographs. I will say, back in the good old days, Chance, we had what I call a Dick and Jane website. So we could post, you know, words and language, but we couldn't post much of anything else. And way back then, I remember still, we were at the ACLU, office in downtown Los Angeles. And I said, gosh, we have a Dick and Jane website. We'd like to grow up. Is anybody in the audience here able to help us? And sure enough, mother of a registrant raised her hand, and she came up and spoke to us later in the meeting and said, I think she said something like, I have a smoking hot computer and I know how to use it. And it was absolutely true. And that person, whose first name is Betty, by the way, she in fact ran our website for at least 5 years. So Betty has moved on to retirement, and the rest of us are relying upon Roger and Chuck for their good work. And as I said, they're serving this community very well. So I want to say that we're going to go back to an old format that we used for quite a while in that old form for this meeting. And the old format is, I'm going to announce some topics and then we're going to have people vote on them. So that's why I'm delaying just a little bit before we get the substance of the meeting here. that I want to give more people an opportunity to sign on. So the agenda, which is where I wanted it to be, we will go through the agenda here. And I declined a phone call. I'm sure somebody's trying to check in. And again, we apologize for the technical difficulties this morning, but we seem to be online, me on a cell phone doing my... Okay, so let's talk about compliance checks. We've talked about compliance checks many times, but the fact is it's an issue that certainly keeps coming up. And I just want to remind people, if you're not on parole, if you are not on probation, if you're not on supervised release, and the police come to your front door, you have the Fourth Amendment that protects you. And so the Fourth Amendment basically says, you know, we can't have any unlawful searches or seizures. And when it comes to compliance checks, what that means is, again, if you are not on parole, if you're not on probation, and if you're not on supervised release, what it means is you don't have to answer the door. So I think that gives some people some comfort knowing that you can answer the door if you want to when you see those uniformed police officers outside. And sometimes I understand they're in SWAT uniforms and they look pretty scary. But the fact is you don't have to answer the door. Now, let's say you choose to answer the door, then what you can do then is step outside your home, whether your home is an apartment or a single family home or a mobile home, whatever form of housing that you have. The fact is you do not have to let the police inside your house. Okay. And that's really important because if somebody's inside of your house, a police officer is inside of your house, and they see anything that they might think is illegal, then in fact, they can conduct a search of your house. So why give them that opportunity? And I'll give you one extreme example that really did happen in LA County, where a registrant let the police in. And again, he wasn't on parole, probation, or supervised release. He let the police in his house. He said, I have nothing to hide. Sure, you can come in the house. So they came into his house. They saw that he had a desktop computer. They said, oh, we would like to look inside of your computer. And he said, sure, I don't have anything to hide. Fortunately, he didn't have anything to hide. But the fact is, the police spent 45 minutes combing through his computer. And I find that quite frightening. Heaven only knows what anybody can find on anybody's computer, including things that you may not have ever clicked on, but somebody sent it to you, and that something might in fact have been some child pornography. So if you're not on parole, if you're not on probation, if you're not on supervised release, you do not have to answer the door to law enforcement. And I recommend that if you do decide to answer the door, you step outside your home so the police can't see inside of your home and talk to them there. Okay. Do you want to add anything to that, Chance?
No, I think that's pretty comprehensive. Thank you.
You're certainly welcome. Okay, so let's talk about one other thing before we start voting on topics here, and that is about scams. So Chance, I know you had a client who had a problem with a scam, and didn't he pay them a whole lot of money?
Well, not necessarily, no.
Okay.
But someone did call me up and had paid a whole lot of money.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, not my client.
Okay.
My clients don't pay a whole lot of money because they call me and I tell them it's a scam. But this person explained to me that they were so frightened that they were calling me afterwards and saying that they already had paid the money, and they were frightened that now maybe they did the wrong thing or they don't know what happened. And, you know, I had to explain the nature of the scam. But you tell the scam so much better than I do. But
All right, I'll do it then.
Yeah.
It's the Chance and Janice show this morning, folks. So yeah. The fact is that what happens is that somehow they get the phone numbers of people on the registry and they call you up, and usually the message is along the following: you have to come back. You did something wrong when you registered. You have to come back in. Might be fingerprints, it might be DNA, any excuse that you can think of. And oh, by the way, if you don't show up immediately with cash or with gift cards, then you're going to get arrested. So I hope if you hear a message like that, alarm bells will go off in your brain. And quite frankly, the person who scammed just texted me. Okay, so at least one of them. That quite frankly, the greatest power you have is just hang up. All right. So you don't have to listen to them. And by the way, I've been told that, I don't know, these folks are theater majors or something. They make it seem very realistic and this impending doom that you're going to be hauled away if, in fact, you don't pay this money directly. I know. And immediately, I know one man, and I think it was in Los Angeles County. He and his wife were very emotionally upset. I got the phone call. The wife was crying and said, they're going to come take my husband away. And, you know, if we don't pay this money immediately. And then, unfortunately, the husband disappeared. And then I got a second frantic phone call. It turned out he went down to the corner for a package of cigarettes and forgot to tell her. But anyway, he was never taken by anybody, and never has this happened. Most of the time, what they do is they tell you, meet me in the parking lot of, and usually it is like a police station or sheriff's station. So that makes it sound a little bit more realistic, I guess. But folks, if you get a call like that, the easiest thing to do is just hang up on them. I know one person said he was going to basically badger them back, but I don't really recommend that. It's a waste of your time and effort, I think. But the fact is, the easiest thing to do when a scammer calls you like that is just to hang up. Anything you want to add, Chance?
Yeah, thank you. I just to underline, you know, just to underline this, this whole scam idea, never will law enforcement call you up and ask you for money directly. They're not going to do that unless they're trying to raise funds for donations for the police association. They're never going to do that. Okay. So never, ever fall for that. If two things to remember: one, if they're asking for money, and two, if they're pressuring you. If they're asking for money, okay, that's a red flag. And also on top of which, they're pressuring you not to hang up and stay on that phone and to get that thing delivered. You know, right away, it's a scam. Hang up the phone. You know, you can just ignore it or call your attorney and have them handle it. But don't have direct communications with people like that, because those flags come up. You know, that's just wrong. No matter how official they sound, no matter what they say, just understand that's not the way business is done. Law enforcement does not do that. Janice, what do you think?
I agree with you completely, Chance. So We're letting you know this has happened, not just in the state of California, but in other states as well. And so we have something that's, from time to time, we add it back to the website so that it will call people's attention to it. I don't know if it's more or less likely to happen during the holidays, but it does happen. And I will say, before closing on this topic, is one person paid the scammers $10,000. And folks, if you pay them any amount of money, you will not get that money back. So because it's impossible to track them down. Okay, so let's go ahead. I think we have a good group of people, maybe not everybody who intended to join the meeting today. And again, for those who just recently signed on, we want to apologize for the technical difficulties today. Not quite sure what happened with Zoom, but it happened. And thanks to Roger, who is our Zoom master, he was able to get us back online. Okay, so these are the major topics that Chance and I were planning to address today, and we'd like you to vote on them. And you can do that using, raising your hands. Let's see. Yes, raising your hands. So if you would be so kind, because I don't know how to use the polling, but let's take it one at a time. The first topic we were thinking of discussing is the ALI, American Law Institute's revised model penal code. If in fact you would like us to talk about that, would you please raise your hand here using Zoom? Don't do it on the screen, because I can't see most of you. But if you go down to the bottom with reactions, I think it is, and you raise your hand, then we can see that you're interested in that topic. And if this doesn't work, we're just going to do it in our own order. So I have to admit, Chance, I'm not seeing the raised hands. How about you?
Yeah, I see raised hands.
Okay. I see two raised hands?
No, I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. 12, and I'm only on one screen.
Okay.
So two. I see 12. 12 hands raised.
Okay, we'll just go with that. Because
just a note for anyone on the phone, it's star 9.
Oh, star 9. Thank you, Roger. Yeah. Okay, well, wait, and I have a couple more people vote. Okay, let's wait another minute or two. Again, while we're waiting for this, what we're doing right now is voting on topics that you'd like to hear Chance and I discuss. And the first one is the ALI Revised Model Penal Code. We've got a status update for everybody, and we would be happy to share that with you. So, Roger, can you count the votes? The raised hands?
The total raised hands, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16.
All right, we'll move on then. And next time, please don't count out loud. Let's move on to the proposed SORNA regulations. So it's a very important topic, obviously, and it could affect everybody on the registry potentially. So if you're interested in Chance and I discussing the proposed SORNA regulations and an update that we have about that, please vote now, either by raising your hand or by pressing *9 if you're on the phone. So again, raise your hand on the bottom of the screen here or press *9 if you would. And, Roger's going to count silently and let me know when he's got a number. And I would imagine the votes are trickling in. So what we're talking about again is the proposed SORNA regulations and how many people are interested in Chance and I discussing that today. And this is a topic that we have discussed in the past and on the website and on monthly meetings. It's unfortunately a topic that hasn't gone away in over a year. Got a number there, Roger?
28.
A lot more people. Okay. Okay, moving on. This is a new issue for us to discuss in a monthly meeting, and that's a question about military retirees and veterans who are being denied access to military bases. So it's something that in some regards it started on November 1, but I'm getting input from many people all over the country about the fact that they're being denied access to a military base or they've been denied access in the past. So this would be the time, folks, if you're interested in the military or access to military bases, please vote now. Again, either by raising your hand or by, if you're on the phone, pressing *9, and they'd be voting in favor of hearing from Chance and I about the military bases and denying access to people on the registry, regardless if you're a veteran or a retiree. And you have a number for us, Roger?
Yeah, just a reminder to everyone, be sure to lower your hand afterward using the same thing so that you don't get counted for a topic you don't want now. 13 so far.
All right. All right. And then the the issue that never stops, travel, both domestic and international travel. As Roger just asked, please lower your hand if you have voted on another issue. But at this point in time, if you want to ask questions about domestic travel or international travel, please raise your hand or press *9 on your phone if you're joined by phone. And Roger's going to count up votes here and we'll see what happens. And folks, we plan to discuss all of these issues? It's really just a question of in what order we're going to discuss them.
19.
Okay, the last issue I'm going to ask people to vote on, and we're going to bring up a few other smaller issues that we're not going to vote on. We'll just fill them in where we have a gap or two, and that is the tiered registry here in California. I think it's of greater interest in, you know, to people outside of California as well. We seem to lead the nation in many things, and we certainly did when it came to the setting up a sex offender registry, I'm ashamed to say. But if you're interested in the tiered registry, please let us know now by raising your hand here or by dialing star and then the 9 key. So *9 or raising your hand, and Roger's going to count up those votes.
Eighteen.
All right. So let's get ready to start then on our first substantive issue. The issue that got the most votes was the proposed SORNA regulations. So a quick recap on that, and then we will go ahead and take questions and answer comments as well, allow people to make comments. And Roger, if you're going to stick with us, I'm going to rely upon you, if you don't mind, to unmute people. All right, thank you so much. Okay, so the federal government published proposed SORNA regulations way back in August of 2020. So it's a year and 5 months ago. So they issued these proposed regulations, they published them in the Federal Register, and quite frankly, they horrified a lot of people. The main problem with these proposed regulations, by the way, is it would require individuals to do things which it may be impossible for them to do. And the clearest example that I, from my perspective, is that it could require people to register four times a year. So in California, most people are only registered once a year. I don't think that California wants to quadruple the expense of registering people four times a year. These proposed SORNA regulations, if they were finalized, could lead to that result. So that is, and there's all kinds of other provisions in there. Like if you were to leave your house for more than 7 days, you have to go tell local law enforcement. And some of these requirements, by the way, are already exist in SORNA compliant states, but quite frankly, only 1/3 of the states, and I believe the number is 17 or 18 now, only 17 or 18 states are SORNA compliant. The rest of our states, including California, where I live and practice law, is not a SORNA compliant state. So you don't have to do things like tell local law enforcement if you're going to leave your home for 7 days. You can go on a 30-day vacation, and as long as you don't overstay your welcome in different states or in different cities within the state, you don't have to notify local law enforcement. So I know a lot of people have expressed a lot of reservations about this, a lot of concerns about these proposed SORNA regulations. And I'm here to tell you that the current status of the proposed regulations right now is that they cleared the Office of Management and Budget. So a lot of you, if you watch TV news like I do and you hear OMB, that's what it stands for, Office of Management and Budget. And OMB has approved these proposed SORNA regulations. So that means that they, in fact, are in front of the Attorney General right now. So we asked Axol started the request of everybody to basically reach out to the Attorney General's office and ask him to stop the proposed regulations. He has the authority to stop the proposed regulations. He can just say, no, I don't think so. I don't think these are reasonable. Or he could say, okay, I do think they're reasonable. And go forward. So we ask people to make phone calls. We ask people to send email messages. We ask people to send letters. And I'm happy to say that many people have done that. And then I have to admit, we don't know what the result is yet. The only thing I can report to you is they haven't been finalized yet. So if the regulations are made final, they have to be published in the Federal Register again. And then after that, Congress has 30 days notice or 30 days in which to object to them, which I think is doubtful, and then they would become law. So right now, that's the status of things. Chance, is there anything you want to add?
Yeah, just to add to this is that we really don't know what the outcome is going to be here as far as, you know, what's going to be there, because he can also pick and choose which ones he wants to do. He can modify this thing. So please don't ask us what's in there, because we don't know. We really don't know until we get some kind of response, and we may never receive a response. Maybe he tables it. Who knows what happens from here? So right. That's the foundation we're on right now.
And I was just asked a question here, I think by chat, maybe by text message. Could we sue the federal government if their proposed regulations are made final? And the answer is yes, with an exclamation point. And that's exactly what we intend to do. So we hope it doesn't come to that. It would be so much easier to stop them, we think, in the Attorney General's office doing this really administrative, almost grassroots effort. And that's why we've asked you all to, again, make phone calls, send email messages, and send letters. It's not too late to do that, by the way. Any day before they're made final, it's not too late. So please tell your friends, family members, whoever you trust and who knows you to do this. And we have we have information on the website about this, and it's easy enough to do. I know I did it myself, and doing all three things together, it took me about an hour. So if you're willing to invest an hour of your time, we can in fact possibly stop these proposed SORNA regulations from coming into existence. So why don't we stop here and ask people to ask questions or make comments. And Roger, I'm not sure the best way to do this. I apologize, folks. I'm on my cell phone and I don't know exactly how to do things that I could do if I was on my desktop. So why don't you go ahead and raise your hand if you have a question, and I'm counting on Roger then to I'm counting on Roger to call on you. He'll ask you to unmute yourself and then you can ask your question. And folks, you were notified when you signed on and that this meeting is being recorded. I want to remind you this meeting is being recorded. So if you want to use some other name, it's quite fine with us. We only ask that we don't have too many Mickey Mouses or Donald Ducks in the same meeting. So maybe you could choose another cartoon character or favorite author. I don't know. Anyway, Roger, do we have anybody with their hand up right now?
Not yet.
Okay. All right. Well, then let me... And I hope we're not having another technical difficulty there. How about this, Roger? Also, what about if they use the chat room? If they ask a question in chat, would that possibly work as well?
Sure. One person said, are we still on for the 5K matching and find update or deadline?
I'm happy to report that we have surpassed the matching, the match of $5,000. However, we are still certainly happy to receive funding to stop the proposed SORNA regulations. So it's easy to donate to the organization and for this cause. Either you can use the website in the homepage of the website on the right hand toward the top, not at the top, but toward the top. There's a lovely button that says donate. So if you click on the donate button, you can donate that way. It's basically we receive the money then through PayPal, or you can mail a check to the organization. And Axol's mailing address is 1215 or 1215 K. K is in Kite Street. And then you have to put comma 17th floor or it won't get there. So 1215 K Street, comma 17th floor. Sacramento, California, and the zip code is 95814. So again, if you want to send a check to the office, that would be wonderful. 1215 K Street, comma 17th floor, Sacramento, 95814. I think it's easier and doesn't require a stamp if you go to the website and use the donate button. But I think I heard another click or another noise. Does that mean we have a comment or a question?
Yes. And Joe, just to make sure that the raise hand is working, could you please raise your hand? Just to make sure it's through. Okay, question, does the compliance check advice apply only to California or to all states?
It applies to all states. The Fourth Amendment is to the U.S. Constitution. So again, if you're not on parole, probation, or supervised release, which means that you have a diminished constitutional rights when you're on paper. Some people just refer to it that way. But once you're off the paper, that it means you're not on parole, you're not on probation, or you're not on supervised release, then the Fourth Amendment does protect you from unlawful searches. By the way, there is another exception there. If they show up with a search warrant, then they can come in your house. But you can ask them at the door ever so politely, do you have a search warrant? By the way, you don't even have to open the door to ask that question. You can ask it through the door. And if they don't have a search warrant, then you can just ignore them. And I know some people have gone to take a bath and turn the music loud. Some people have baked cookies, you know, scrub the floor, whatever you want to do with your time. Again, you can ignore somebody who shows up at your door if you're not on parole, if you're not on probation, and you're not on supervised release. Okay. Any other questions or comments at this point? Roger?
You are relieved of registering in California for child porn. Are you still on SORNA list for the additional 5 years? And would you still get a qualifier and be limited in travel? Passport qualifier through SORNA if off California registration? We'll comment.
That's kind of a complicated question, and I'm going to do my best to answer the question that I think I heard. And if it's not, then please go ahead and make another comment. So if you're lucky enough in California to get your petition granted, and that means you're no longer required to register in this state, as long as you're not required to register in any other state, your requirement to have a unique identifier added to your passport no longer exists. So if that's the question, that's my answer. Chance, did you hear something different, or was there something you would like to add?
Yeah, I'm not sure if they were asking, you know, could you, Roger, can you repeat that? It's very complicated and it involved like two or three different things.
You are relieved of registering in California for child porn. Are you still on SORNA list for the additional 5 years? And would you still get a qualifier and be limited in travel?
Okay, so, you know, part of that, Janice answered. I'm not sure if you're asking if SORNA is applied, if the regulations go through and SORNA is applied. There's going to be an issue in California. And the issue is going to be whether or not you fall under the definition of conviction for SORNA. California is a unique state. For those who've been granted probation and have achieved a dismissal, you may be in one category. And for those who have been paroled out of prison, you may be in another. We don't know yet, and I hazard to guess, but I do say that California is a unique place. It has been recognized as such by the Attorney General in 2007 in defining who comes under a conviction for SORNA purposes. And that was kind of ratified through an evaluation of California in 2016. So again, that depends. That question is a very complex one. And I would say that for further discussion on that, you should contact either Janice or I, and we should just break that down and go through each piece independently, because that will take a while.
Yeah, thank you, Chance, for that. Okay. Before we go to the next caller, there's something that I would like to mention, because we're also going to talk about the ALI Revised Model Penal Code. And I'm hoping that there becomes a very strong link between these two things. And so, in case you don't know what in the heck I'm talking about, let's take a step backwards. The ALI, American Law Institute, a very prestigious organization, which, by the way, one of its members is the Attorney General of the United States, Merrick Garland, and judges and other people who are considered experts in the field. In fact, they have about 3,000 members. So ALI, in June of this year, so 5 months ago, basically approved a revised model penal code. And in the revised model penal code, they had some really significant things to say and to recommend. Now that model penal code, and if you don't mind, I'll just refer to it as the MPC. That MPC is not law. It's a recommendation. But the fact is that states pay attention to what ALI recommend. And in fact, it's up to them to choose whether or not to adopt all or part of it. So because the Attorney General, remember that the proposed SORNA regulations are under his review right now. And what we're hoping is that he and what we've done our best to do, but are continuing our efforts to make sure he knows about the ALI MPC, because the fact is that the provisions of that code are so drastically different than the proposed SORNA regulations that they shouldn't exist on the same planet, quite frankly. So what we're saying is, please, Attorney General, look at what your organization did. And by the way, ALI took 9 years. They had a very methodical, very thorough approach here on the model penal code before they came up with these recommendations. By the way, one of the recommendations is this: there should be no one person who's on the registry for more than 15 years. Just think about that. And by the way, you'll be automatically removed. It wouldn't be that like in California now, you have to petition for removal. It would just be automatic, right? And most people at the 10-year period would be eligible to petition for removal. So you might get off in only 10 years. And so I know in California, we have people who've been on the registry for 40, 50 years. And if the ALI was adopted, they would immediately be removed from the registry. So, the general topic here is in fact, the proposed SORNA regulations. But I think Chance and I at this point in time are willing and able to answer questions you might have on either the proposed SORNA regulations or the model penal code. So if you have a question or comment about either one of those topics, please raise your hand here electronically, or you can, if you're on the phone, press *9, or I guess you can also use the chat room, which I don't have access to, but Roger's informing Chance and I what it says. So Roger, do we have anybody in those categories?
We do. Go ahead, Dave.
Good afternoon from Illinois. Thank you again for having this talk for us. Do you recommend, or either one of you recommend, that each individual state, like I get a group together, we go, in my case, Springfield, the state capital, with the ALI, and try and get a brief, obviously a very brief talk sheet to give out to our legislators? How do we educate?
Yes, thank you for asking that question or making that comment. That's absolutely what needs to happen. But I want to tell you, it's not quite ready to do that. And the only reason I say that is because even though the members of ALI adopted this in June of this year, their leadership hasn't adopted it yet. And we've been told by an ALI member, who's one of our board members, also, that they will do that next month in December. So we just have a couple more weeks, maybe 30 days to wait until the ALI leadership gives final approval to these proposed the MPC. And at that point in time, AXOL, and I'm putting my hand up and I'm volunteering to do this, we will give you a one-page point paper that you can take to your legislature, because that's how they communicate. I'm a former congressional staffer myself, and you have to make it so basic for them, right? So you have to go and break it down to one page. Now you can give them supplemental information or give them links to supplemental information, but we will do that for you. And we have to wait until the leadership votes, because we've been told that there's no problem is expected whatsoever in this. So the leadership is in fact expecting to approve what the members voted upon in June. And but we don't have full access, by the way, to what they've done. So we have something on our website right now as one of the draft proposals. We don't have necessarily the final wording. And also importantly, we don't have the background information. So for them to come out and make a recommendation that nobody should be on the registry more than 15 years, right? How are they backing that up? Because that's the kind of information, that we all can share with our state legislators. So thank you for that question. Chance, do you want to add anything to that?
No, that was good. Okay, thanks for that question, though. Appreciate it.
Next is Dennis. Go ahead, Dennis.
Yeah, what does ALI stand for again?
American Law Institute. And if you if you are curious about the ALI, I highly encourage you to go online and type in model penal code or something like that, or just penal code, and you will get to this. And I want to tell you that there were two people who worked on this project for 9 years, a man and a woman, both attorneys. I remember her name, Erin Murphy. I'm sorry, I don't remember his name. But the fact is that They shepherded this project through this process, and they are both in videos that are on the ALI website. And I took the time yesterday to listen to all of one of those video messages and a part of another one, because the other one was almost 30 minutes long. But the one that I listened to was about 8 minutes long, and both of them spoke. And their term is reporter, which I don't know about you, but when I hear that, I think, oh, they're a newspaper reporter. No, they're not newspaper reporters at all. But instead, what they're doing, they were the people who led the effort within ALI. I know that the woman, her first name is Erin. Her whole name is Erin Murphy, and she actually is a law professor. And again, the gentleman's name I don't have in front of me, and I'm not sure what his background is. But they spent 9 years on this project, and she, Erin Murphy, had some very positive things to say about this. She basically said, you know, ALI had not made any recommendations about people convicted of sex offenses for over 50 years, right? And she said, she didn't come right out and say the system is broken, but she certainly suggested that improvements were necessary. And that's one reason she and all the ALI members worked for 9 years on this. And by the way, another provision of their model penal code is this, that no registry would be made available to the public. And I think that's huge. I mean, what if the public didn't know, as what happened in the past, it's law enforcement only? I think that would make a big difference in the lives of people who are in the registry. Chance, you want to add anything to that before we go to the next caller?
Totally agreed. Again, these are recommendations, and it's for jurisdictions, you know, jurisdictions meaning states, to adopt. Hopefully, over time, we can convince California to accept these recommendations and put them to use in our state. I would love to see that. That would change the whole playing field. So these are very promising, very promising.
I certainly agree. Roger, next caller, please, or commenter.
David, go ahead.
Thanks. I this is splitting hairs, and you answered, and I didn't follow up on my own question. Besides the state legislator, would you also recommend that this go to our governor's offices?
You know what? That's a really good point. And yes, go to the governor's office as well. Certainly, if you have the governor's support, the legislature, I think, would follow along. And in California, I'm very happy to report that the governor of California has established a committee on revising our penal code, as it turns out. They've only been in existence now for about 2 years, and their first year of recommendations, some of those recommendations, it has nothing to do with our topic, by the way, but some of those topics and recommendations, rather, have in fact already been turned into laws. So obviously the governor is listening to this committee, but so are members of the legislature. Actually, there are two legislators committee. Again, this is in California. We have an assembly member and a Senate member, and there's only 7 members of the committee, and 2 of them are legislators. So I think so our goal here in California is, in fact, to introduce the ALI model penal code to the governor's commission committee, rather, on revising the model penal code. So I think first things first, that folks in every state should find out, does their governor have a committee or some other group of people who are looking at the penal code and, you know, planning to revise it? If so, it's so much easier to fold into something that already exists, right, than to create something new. But if you have to, go ahead and try to convince the governor to start a committee or start a commission, they want to call it, right, that will go back and look at the model penal codes. Because folks, we know that the laws dealing with registrants in every state are broken. They're not based on logic. Most of them are based on fear or some, you know, one-time event, and often a tragic one-time event. I'm not trying to downplay it at all. When Mega Kanka was, kidnapped, sexually assaulted and murdered, that's thing. There's no doubt about it. But the thing is that really the reason to basically say nationwide that everybody on the registry or practically everybody should be known to the public? Because the public obviously doesn't know what to do with this information. And I have plenty of examples, but I won't use them now. But that's a great idea. Also, reach out to your governor's office as well as the legislature. Thank you.
And I'm sorry, as long as I'm on a roll, we're going to flip now to the Fed side. What about our Congress representatives and or U.S. senators? Basically, should we flood everyone?
I think the answer is yes. I'm not quite sure how to do it on the federal side. I mean, we would love them to adopt it, but it might be the easy answer might be you start with the Attorney General, right? So the Attorney General is in fact in charge of the SORNA and the SORNA regulations. Well, actually he's in charge of SORNA regulations, but if he were to make a recommendation to Congress, right, that, oh gosh, gee whiz, let's just flush all these SORNA regulations where they belong down the toilet, right? And let's bring in the model penal code instead, I think that would go a long way. So there are certain things I'm not willing to discuss right now going on behind the scenes, trying to communicate directly with or through a third party to get to the Attorney General to make sure he knows about this model penal code. And he would hopefully, and remember, he's a member of ALI. He may, in fact, have voted in favor of this model penal code. We don't know that yet. But the fact is that that's one person who might be very valuable in this entire process. So I thank you for that.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
The next comment is written. Lakewood, Colorado, a suburb of Denver, has implemented a kiosk for registration. A person can go to the police department anytime they're open, within the 5 days before or after requirements, and log into the kiosk with their username and fingerprint for a password. The previous registration information is filled in. So if there are no changes, you take your picture, the camera's on the kiosk, sign the registration with your finger, receive a hard copy, and you're done. There's no interaction with the person.
Hey, you know, maybe they should do that with voting.
An appointment is required for your birthday registration.
Great idea there, Chance.
Cool. God, how easy is that? Wow.
You know, my only concern about that, quite frankly, I mean, I think it's great in many respects, but my only concern would be, what if you have some vigilante who's just waiting at the kiosk for the next person to show up?
Or what about registration fraud? Maybe someone else is going to do that.
I think Roger said that they had to use a thumbprint. Was it Roger?
Yeah.
Okay. So I think that there wouldn't be so, So again, that's a small concern and certainly would want to protect the privacy of somebody on the registry. But anyway, it's a novel approach and be interesting to watch to see what happens.
Yeah, I share the same concern Janice does. I was kidding there for a moment about registration fraud, but it would, you know, if folks start to learn that that's the process, it may be risque to do it that way because people will be waiting by the box. So I'm not sure I like that too much.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that happened during the pandemic and the silver lining to this very dark cloud is that a lot of registrants in California anyway, and certainly in Los Angeles, which is the biggest concentration of registrants in our state, they were allowed to register by phone, right? Mm-hmm. Why not? Or let's by Zoom, okay? So then you could be in the privacy of your own home. I'm just really concerned for the safety of somebody on the registry where they're in the kiosk with shoppers all around them and people who have the software now where you can, you know, the software apps where you can basically scan somebody's face and find out whether or not they're on the registry. But you wouldn't have to guess. And if somebody is there that means to do harm to a registrant, that would be my really grave concern. So I think somebody didn't think it out completely.
Agreed.
Roger, do we have another question or comment?
Michael, go ahead.
Yes, hi. Question is, does the Attorney General have a certain amount of time to make a decision on the SORNA regulations?
No, he doesn't have a deadline. I think that's your question. So he can sit there and forever and never act upon it. Kind of reminds me like of a pocket veto, right? I think all legislators have a pocket veto. The president does too. The fact is that no, he can just sit on it forever. And that could in fact kill it right then in that way. But yeah. And so I guess maybe the big difference is it doesn't have to be some, you know, some big action that hits the TV news. If you think about it, maybe that would be the best way to do it, right? And so when basically somebody doesn't do something, most of the time it's not reported that they didn't do something. I actually like that a lot, the pocket veto. So let's hope that that's what he does. If not, you know, send it through the shredder and said, no, not on my watch. But, and again, I just want to remind people, it's not too late. Make the phone calls, send the emails and mail letters as well. I mean, this is the time. And I commend many other organizations, by the way. Because I did it. I reached out to other organizations in addition to Axol and said, please, 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 you know, send this information out to your members. And a lot of the other organizations did. And this is one way, by the way, organizations throughout the country that are all here for the same purpose, which is to help people on the registry and their loved ones. This is how we can all work together. And I'm very, very happy to see that happening. Thank you.
Ivan is next. Go ahead, Ivan.
Do I hear a question? Is there a question there, Roger?
I think Roger's just Ivan, called
everybody. Go ahead, Ivan.
Yeah, you just now unmuted me. Hi, guys. Along with bringing information to legislators, I think here's another important thing for, at least I'm in the non-contact variety of registrant. And in case some of you guys don't know, there was a United States Sentencing Commission report that came out in 2021. They studied every single person released from federal prison, and there was 1,097 of them, studied them for 3 years. And the recidivism rate was 4.3% for a sexual offense, but 36 of those were of a contact nature. So basically, for a non-contact offender, the rate of the risk is 1.3%. So why would the person, you know, the idea of the sex offender registry, you know, warn people about potential, you know, people lurking in the neighborhood? Why would somebody with a non-contact offense be on a sex offender registry when the chances are 1.3% that he would have a contact offense? So, you know, something also should be brought to legislators. And then on the tier, I just like to say on the tier registry, the thing about us non-contact people being tier three, if you look at the California Sex Offender Management Board report regarding this, tier three is defined as sexually violent predators, kidnappers, offenders with repeat violent sex offenses, high risk sex offenders. Well, so I just don't get how this gets squared and fixed.
Well, thank you so much for that information about the US sentencing report. So, That is something that I'm going to delve into. There's all kinds of data out there, folks, that shows that the rate of reoffense for somebody on the sex offender registry is extremely low. And, you know, unfortunately, that's not the information that is shared. Instead, people talk about the recidivism rate, and recidivism rate includes parole violations. And that number, unfortunately, is really high. I know it's over 75%, but, you know, that doesn't surprise me. I mean, if somebody's told, and now in California, we've got people on parole for up to 20 years. And so for 20 years, you can't have any alcohol. You can't have anything that your parole officer thinks might be a toy that you don't think is a toy. You know, all these things, it's really very easy to end up getting violated on parole. So it really, you know, it's very important about the statistics. And so absolutely that report would be valuable. We have another source in California, which when I sue the Department of Corrections here, I love to remind them of their own report, which is it shows that a registrant while on parole, the chance of reoffense committing a new sex offense is less than 1%. And I don't even say the exact amount, because if I do, then somebody will take that and move the decimal point. So I just say it's less than 1%. And that's using CDCR's own data. So it's a very valuable message that needs to get out there. So I will go find that report. And I think it's maybe write an article and add it to our website as well. So thank you for that information. Chance, do you want to add anything right now?
Yeah, actually, the federal system, let's just say the SORNA system, reflects that data. People who commit non-contact offenses generally, and CP in particular, is in tier one. Whereas in California, we flip it and we put them on tier three. God knows why. But
I know why.
Well, Janice knows why. And actually, I know why.
But okay.
The thing is that it doesn't belong there, along with a bunch of other things on tier three that just no misdemeanor really belongs on tier three. But let's just focus on what we're talking about here, which is non-contact offenses in particular. And Janice will explain this in a minute. But federally, everybody, you know, it's a federal recognition of what you're talking about versus what California does. And this is just not a justifiable thing. Janice?
Absolutely. The only reason that all CP offenses, felony CP offenses, are in tier three in California is because of a political compromise. It's not because of reason. It's not because of logic. It's because it was a political compromise. So we almost lost the tiered registry bill in California, and a last ditch effort, the author of the bill accepted this compromise, and it stinks to high heaven. And people, I keep apologizing to everybody. Trust me, nobody asked us if we thought that was a good idea, because we would have said heck no. And so this is one of the few times when SORNA is actually easier for some people, even on the California registry, because as Chance just said, that CP possession on SORNA is tier one. I don't know about production or distribution, but there are some CP offenses on tier two in SORNA, but under SORNA there are no tier three SORNA tier assignments. By the way, I just want to say that at the Sex Offender Management Board here in California on 2 days ago, a couple of board members started talking about the tiered system and how it's not right and how it needs to be fixed. That was a pretty bold statement. Two people who are members of that board made that comment. There wasn't any follow-up yet, but I'm hoping to, that's a spark, and then we can fan it into flames. Maybe Chance, the Sex Offender Management Board will let us come back and do just that.
Yeah, I would like that. I would like that.
So Chance and I have made presentations to the board before, and it was quite amazing. The first, early on when we made presentations, people yawned a lot and looked the other way. This last time when we made a presentation, we got applause.
Yeah, by everybody. That was very
nice. That was quite nice. Okay, Roger, got any more questions here, comments?
Can I follow up with one thing?
Sure.
Okay, I just want to ask you something, because the reason these reports are familiar to me is I think that my being published on as tier three is damaging my business and my ability to hire people, because they find me on a registry sooner or later, and I don't tell them I'm a registrant when I hire salespeople, and I lose them, even ones that are doing well. So I'm going to go to court. My judge is Christina Snyder, and try, and I don't know if this is possible, but I'm going to ask her to order the California board not to publish me based on this information, and to treat me in regard to that as tier one. And then I'm also, secondly, I don't know if you guys have ever run into this subject, but you know, we have this First Amendment right to look at adult pornography. And there was this Fourth Amendment case, United States versus Robert Dale Ellis, where he was not allowed to look at adult pornography, and he was doing that daily. And the judge and the appellate court sided with him, that unless in the sentencing probation conditions, and unless there's some valid reason, you can't take away somebody's First Amendment right for without backing it up. And in my case, it's just a broad brush. They paint everybody with that same condition as like part of their therapy or whatever. So okay. I'm going to fight that.
Well, please keep us apprised of what happens. I wish you well. I don't predict success, unfortunately. And I think what has to happen instead is the law has to be changed. But you know what? It's worth doing, and I commend you for doing it.
Well, the law is actually in my favor. I mean, according to the position on this fourth, you know, circuit ruling, it seems like it's in my favor, unless the therapist can come in and rationalize why, you know, this is needed. They'll have to come up with reasons.
Well, you brought up two different matters. So one of them is access to adult pornography. I think that's what you're talking about now. Yeah. What I was referring to earlier was your other issue that you're, the tier assignment.
Okay. Yeah. I'm not asking her to change my tier assignment. I'm just going to ask her not to, to order them not to publish my information as if I was.
I get it now. Okay. Well, good luck.
Thank you.
Good luck. Thank you.
Roger?
John, go ahead.
I didn't hear the name, Roger.
John, there he is. He unmuted himself.
Okay, just got unmuted. Good morning, and thank you both. Thank you both for everything you're doing for us. Quick question on the pocket veto. It doesn't lapse, does it?
What doesn't lapse?
As far as the AG doing a pocket veto with the SORNA regs. I mean, if he doesn't take any action, what's to prevent the next administration coming in and reviving that and saying, now we're just going to push this on through?
There would be nothing, I don't think. Though, I mean, at that point in time, those regulations would be so stale, I think they would at least republish them. But I guess I'm so focused on near term, I can't even think about the next administration. But I'm happy you are. And you know, the other thing is, within this administration, it's possible that there could be a new AG. Let's see, Mayor Garland, maybe he would become a U.S. Supreme Court justice, and then we'd have to have a new attorney general. That's speculation on some people's part.
That would be cool. The other question I have is regarding these regulations. I know in California, we have the Administrative Procedures Act to attack regulations that aren't in compliance with the APA. Is there a federal APA that has anything similar to California's APA and the requirements?
Absolutely. In fact, our second lawsuit that challenged the international Megan's Law, we challenged it under APA. We were not successful, but we challenged it under that. So yeah, they have a very robust Administrative Procedures Act in the federal government.
Cool. So if that's the case, then I know California's got, like, I think if I remember right, 7 different elements that you have to check off the box on. And when you file a request for determination, you can hit them on every one of those. And if they don't respond to questions or comments, usually in comments on the proposed regs, they are also supposed to come up with an alternative. And I don't know, that would be a very, very long process to push through as far as these SORNA regs. And again, I'm not sure how that happens. If they revise them, do we get to comment, and can we attack them on the federal APA?
It depends how they do it. I don't want to belabor this point, but I'm happy to talk to you offline, because I think a lot of people really don't care about the APA. I do care about it. I cared about it when I was a federal government attorney, and I care about it now. And so, you know, any way we can throw sand in the gears, let's do it. But first things first, what I want people to focus on today, and until at least for the near term, is let's stop the regulations from becoming final. Okay, if they become final, then we'll be attacking them in the court, because quite frankly, I don't think there's any way in heck that the Congress is going to stop them. I don't think most congressional members have much of a backbone, and you know, they think that this would be too dangerous of an issue for them to take a position on, with one exception, Congressman Bobby Scott from Virginia. But the rest of them, as far as I'm concerned, a bunch of jellyfish. Or worse. And so we can't count on them. So I think if these regulations are finalized in the Federal Register, then we're gearing up, and we're going to, you know, we'll litigate. So thank you for your comments. So I appreciate that.
Thank you.
All right, Mike is next. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, hi. Just wanted to make the observation, since we're on the subject of parole violations, that the great majority of parole violations aren't necessarily even criminal in nature. They're primarily administrative, that something's been done that the PO, for whatever reason, doesn't like, and that's problematic in many states.
Absolutely. Well, I mentioned drinking alcohol. So as long as you're of legal age, for goodness sake, it should be legal for you to have a beer or a glass of wine or whatever else you want. But the fact is that it can be a parole condition that you not consume alcohol, you know, during the whole period of your parole. And as I also said, and it bears repeating, in California, some people are on parole for 20 years. So you can tell me somebody's not going to have a drink of alcohol for 20 years. Maybe I'm showing my colors about how I like my glass of wine at night, but the fact is that, you know, I can't imagine not having alcohol for 20 years. Now, if you're an alcoholic, there's a good reason for you not to be drinking alcohol. And I'm not saying you are a caller, but I'm just saying, you know, in general, alcoholics should not be drinking alcohol, but because I don't fit in that category, then I certainly would be upset. And somebody telling me I can't drink alcohol for 20 years. And then there's, you know, that other really murky area about things like, and this is a real true story about you can't have a toy. I'll tell two quick stories. So one of them, a gentleman had gone in Los Angeles to a baseball game, whatever the professional teams are, I forget. So the fact is he got a souvenir bat. Everybody at that game that day got a souvenir bat for free just because they were there. And so he didn't think much of it. He put it in the backseat of his car, and that was that, until his parole officer went and searched his car and found the souvenir bat and said, "Oh my God, you have a toy in your car." And it's like,
when you say toy, do you mean sex toys?
No, a toy, something you could buy at Toys R Us if they were still in business. And here's another one with another client of mine. That first one was a client of mine. The second one is a client of mine. And his probation officer tried to violate him on probation after 4 years and 9 months of a 5-year term. She tried to violate him on probation because he had Angry Birds game on his cell phone. Now, it turns out that with the work that he does as an IT guy, he would download software on people's computers at work, and he would have to sit, you know, at their desk for 15, 20 minutes. And that's one of the things he liked to do, is play Angry Birds. So the probation officer tried to say, the only reason you have Angry Birds on your phone is to attract children. And thank goodness that day we had a senior judge who saw through that nonsense and declared it to be nonsense. And he did not violate that man on probation. So that was a good day. But yeah. But that's what I'm trying to say. There's just so much ambiguity about parole and probation conditions. And that's why many people, if not most people, commit at least one parole violation. Chance, I'm sure you have something to add to that.
I do. Of course, you know, the question refers to hyper-technical reasons for parole violations. You can come up with almost anything. And most of the time, it has to do with an attitude or a perception about what you can or can't do on probation without actually understanding how you should navigate probation or parole. And if you fail that attitude test, or if you have a conflict with a parole agent or a probation agent, you're in trouble. I'll give you an example. I knew of a man who really did pretty well on parole up until just about the last few days when the agent came for a compliance check. All he had in his place, one book, the Bible. And inside the Bible, pictures of Jesus with children. it's laughable, right? But he was violated for having pictures of children in his place. So, and his parole was extended. So it's not really laughable, because these hyper-technical rules can really be applied very unfairly and very unevenly. And so you have to understand, you have to understand where you are in terms of your vulnerability on either probation or parole, and abide by the conditions as much as humanly possible. There are conditions that are unreasonable, and those should be challenged or litigated. But for the most part, you're really sliding on ice, kind of, and you just got to navigate it properly.
I suppose a lot depends on the particular PO that you get assigned.
That's absolutely true, and your relationship with them, as is most things, even in law, in the courtroom, and everywhere else, as is most things, relationship.
And I will add to that, when I talk to people who are on parole, which is quite often, one of the things that I say to them, and I always apologize, I hate to bring up this analogy, but it's very accurate, which is when you're on parole, you're on a leash, and the person holding the other end of the leash is your parole officer. And the fact is, the parole officer can make the leash longer or shorter depending upon whether or not they trust you. And how important it is, because I've talked to people who are just out of custody for a week or less, and say it's really important in the first 6 months of that time to develop a positive relationship with your parole officer. Because if he or she doesn't think that he can or she can trust you, then guess what? That leash is going to get shorter. On the other hand, if they think that they can trust you and that you're not going to embarrass them or worse, then in fact, they make it longer. Do you want to add to that, Chance?
No, that's just really good advice, and that's completely true. And so, yeah, that's excellent. Thank you, Janice.
And you're welcome. Roger, do we have any others right now?
Someone texted me, do you feel the same about supervised release?
Yes.
That's what we've been talking about, supervised release.
But usually, though, when people are on a supervised release, they don't have as many conditions, the same as probation or similar to probation, that there are fewer conditions usually with probation than parole. Parole's the worst. It's where you have the most restrictions. So, but still, yes, it's really important to have a good relationship with the person who's supervising you and that he or she can trust you. And folks, you know what? Most parole officers, the one thing they really care about, by the way, is not you. What they care about is their job, right? And so they just want to know that you're not going to embarrass them or worse, because if you do, they might lose their job. So, in some respects, it's not personal to you, even though it feels very personal. But the fact is that if a person, if that person trusts you, and guess what? You're going to be allowed to do things that you might not otherwise be able to do. And during the holiday time, I think it's appropriate to bring up this example, which is I had a client who was on parole and he really wanted to go to a holiday meal with his extended family. And yes, there were going to be people there who were, less than 18 years old, minors. And because he had a positive relationship with his parole officer, and it was more than a year after he went on parole, the parole officer said, okay, and granted him permission that one time for that one meal, right, that one day to do that. And it meant a lot to him, as it might mean a lot to a lot of people.
Okay, the last question is from Roger. Go ahead, Roger K.
I just wanted to clarify on the kiosk. This is not in a public area. It's in the police department. You have to go into the police department, go through the metal detector. But instead of going downstairs after spending time making an appointment and waiting for someone to come out, you can go directly to the kiosk, which is out of sight of the entrance area, and do your thing. It takes like 2 minutes. And one of the benefits is, along with the time saving, is there's no cost for it. Whereas before it was $25 every time you went in. So it's great for folks that have to register quarterly.
Well, you know what? Bad. Thank you for that additional information. I thought they were doing it in the middle of a shopping mall.
No, it's in exactly the same place where we registered before, just much easier, and it makes good sense.
Okay, that sounds better.
Yeah, I feel a lot better about that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
No other questions.
Okay, I'm back. I don't know about you all, but I have a cup of coffee. I just made myself a cup of coffee. So that's why I was off camera.
let's see. If there are no more questions, let's go on to the next topic. And the next topic has to do with people being denied access to military bases. So this only came to my attention about 2 weeks ago when a registrant who is well known to our organization because he attends all kinds of meetings and makes donations as well. And he's a retired Air Force officer, He lives near an Air Force base, and he depends on the Air Force base for medical care. And in fact, he was in the middle of his annual physical exam when he went to the front gate of that Air Force base and was basically told for the first time that he was not going to be allowed to come on base. So it's just like, what? I mean, it was a complete shock to him. He got no advance warning that he might not be able to come on the base. So that was the first person. And I have a friend who's on the foundation board, whose husband is on the registry and also retired military. He was in the Navy. And so I warned her about what happened to the Air Force retiree. And sure enough, it happened to her husband, who is a Navy retiree, 2 days later. So after that, I asked people to call me, and I asked people to send me emails. And I'm grateful to all of those who did. And there's a pretty large number, I'm afraid. And what I found out is there's people being denied access to military bases all over our country. And I'm a veteran myself. I'm not a retiree. I served on active duty in the Navy. And I don't use military bases, but I know there are a lot of people who do, and especially people to, you know, who retired from a service. I mean, I think everybody, in order, no matter what the service is, you have to at least have served for 20 years in order to be retired from the military. And it just seems to me unconscionable, quite frankly, that a military retiree would be turned away. So before, so why don't you think about it? If you have a question or comment, raise your hand here using Zoom or dial *9. And then I'm going to ask, maybe we'll just do it with the people who ask questions and that. Just wondering how many different states are represented on the call today or this meeting today. And so I'm not sure, Roger, maybe if you have some other idea of how we can find that out. Again, it's nothing scientific. It's just we'd like to know if we have people, certainly people outside the state of California who are part of today's meeting.
Well, we could have, after the questions, we could have everyone who's outside California raise their hand.
Okay, I like that.
In the meantime, okay. It looks like Ron is first person. Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, hello, I'm Ron, and I'm from Lorton, Virginia, which is close to Fort Belvoir, Virginia, here in the northern part of the state, outside of Washington.
And is, is that an Army base, Fort Belvoir?
Yes, but it's a joint base. There's all services represented there. And there's a, okay. There's a medical center over there as well, a fairly nice right. medical center. I'm a military, mm-hmm. I'm Air Force retiree, 27 plus years, retired as a colonel. Unfortunately, post-retirement, within the first year, I had a sexual offense, which I won't get into, but I served 2 years of probation. And throughout this whole time, I've had a valid military ID. And I've been using Fort Belvoir for its various services for which I'm entitled for, probably the most important of which is the medical care. And my wife also uses it. Of course, I'm able to use the commissary and PX and so forth. But last Saturday, for the very first time, I hadn't been on the post in probably 10 days. I guess last Saturday was the, help me out, Sheila, the date. Whatever, the 6th of November, of course, a week after this new policy went into place, I was denied access to the base, and I was shocked. The civilian gate guard said, I'm sorry, but I need to make a phone call. I was in line for about 15 minutes waiting, and eventually I was turned back, and the gentleman showed me his monitor that he scans the ID card with, and it had my picture, and it said, you know, sex offender. And I was like, apparently this information has been out there all along.
Wait. So the monitor that this guard was using had the term sex offender on it?
Yes, they have what they call DBIDS. It's a system, basically.
DBIDS. Mm-hmm.
DBIDS. that apparently I'm in this national database. I have been for some time, ever since I've been, you know, on off of probation and so forth. But the military, I guess all the branches of the service of the military have not pulled this information into their DOD system thus far. But so I guess the 1st of November is the first time they did that. So I think what's happened here is, frankly, I've been prevented from, I guess, by regulation from being on that installation, but they didn't know it until they, this new law went into effect when they started pulling the data in.
Okay, so stop. It's not a law. Okay, well, understand, not a law. Not that I'm aware of anyway, but there is a directive. And so I'm going to interrupt you because I want to give people some facts and then I'll come back to you, okay?
Sure. Yep.
Okay, so you mentioned something about starting, I think, November 1. And based upon information that I have a directive from the U.S. Marine Corps headquarters, and it is dated in May of 2021, but it says it goes into effect on November 1 of 2021. And that's consistent with the information that I've gotten from most people. Some people have said they were denied a long time ago. So let me tell you what it says briefly. I'm going to put my glasses on so I can read properly. And it basically says anybody who is currently required to register cannot come on base. Okay, currently required to register. But then also it says anybody who has ever been convicted of sexual assault, rape, child molestation, or possession or production of child pornography. So with those four offenses, if you have ever been convicted of them, even if you're no longer required to register. So folks, I'm outraged by this. And I don't know if it's because I'm a military veteran or not, or just because I really care about registrants. I think that's more like it, that how in the world can they take this away from you? If you've spent 20 years or longer in the military service and you're now one of their pensioners, you're a retiree, for goodness sake, this is a benefit that was promised to you long ago, and possibly, you know, one of the reasons, in fact, that you decided to make a career of it. And John, the gentleman who was just talking, and I'm sorry, I forget your first name. Was it Roger?
It's Ron.
Ron. Okay, Ron, that you're talking about the fact that you're used to getting your medical care on base. And the first gentleman who contacted me, as I said, he was in the middle of his physical examination, his annual physical. And I contacted him again yesterday to get more details. And it turns out that the military has provided all of his medical care for him since the age of 21. And he's now in his 60s. So, you know, I mean, this is just a huge, huge difference in his life. And he is not knowing how to cope with it. And
this is exact same situation with myself. And I should add also, this past week, I did manage to get back to Fort Belvoir at the visitor center outside the gate. I went in there to ask him for some questions. There is a process for a waiver. I was provided a package that I must complete that will basically petition the installation commander, a full colonel, give me a waiver potentially, but I have to go to the local Fairfax County court to get the documents they need and so forth. But so there's a process, it's going to take some time. If I do get allowed access to Fort Belvoir, that's not going to allow me access to other installations. We'll have to go through their process as well. I'm sure that each installation has their own process for that granting of a waiver. So I haven't won the battle. I mean, win the battle, but not the war.
Yeah, I don't think you've even won a battle, I'm afraid. You're given a handful, maybe a pistol, but you got Goliath coming after you. I would really like you to contact me if you would during next week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of next week. I will be taking Thursday, Friday off. So everybody, in case you don't already know, my direct phone number is area code 805-896-7854. Again, 805-896-7854. My email address is J as in Janice, M as in Mary, Bellucci, and Bellucci is spelled Bellucci at AOL.com. Okay, so jmbellucci at AOL.com, my phone number. Call me, contact me, and let me know. I think you're Ron, your story is particularly compelling, as is the case of Joe. I'll just refer to him as Joe, who's the retired Air Force officer. And again, he's had all of his medical needs met by the military since age 21. He also, by the way, was given a packet of information and said, oh, these are all the things that you have to do. And you know, I looked at it myself, and my rough estimate is it's going to take him a year or longer to get through this process. In the meantime, and by the way, to his detriment, he was just diagnosed with diabetes. And so here he is, a newly diagnosed diabetic person, and he doesn't know what to do. And they can't get onto the military base to find out.
Yeah. I have other details, but I would definitely call you and provide you with more details.
Yeah, thank you. You're certainly welcome. And folks, I want to tell you that we do have a challenge grant, and this is the first mention of it. We'll add it to the website as well. But somebody has, in fact, donated $2,500 for a matching challenge grant, this time for the issue of military access to military bases. So if that's something that you can do, whether it's $5 or $500, please consider making a donation to AXSOL. And you can even put in the memo line that this is what it's for. I, by the way, had a meeting yesterday with another attorney in another state about this. He's a former military officer in JAG, Judge Advocate General, and he's very interested in this issue as well. And so we are now individually doing different parts of the legal research that's required, because this to me seems like it's necessary for litigation. And, you know, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. And I'm not even directly involved. But anyway, it's really, really a serious issue. And I just want you to know that we're taking it very seriously. And we, you know, good chance that we're going to end up litigating this. And when you litigate something like this, understand it's going to take a long time to reach a final answer, unless, like, as I just described the gentleman here in California, we might pursue injunctive relief for him so he can get on the base and get his immediate medical needs met. If he's a diabetic and he's not being treated, I'm really concerned for his health, and that he, I'll just say I'm concerned for his health. Okay, Roger, do we have other folks waiting?
Yes, Rafael, go ahead. Go ahead, Rafael.
I'm muted, Roger.
Thank you.
There you go.
Thank you for taking my call and for the work that you both do.
You're welcome.
The question on this issue is, will that eventually affect the veteran medical clinics or hospitals that are not in the bases?
I don't know the answer to that question. I would really appreciate if somebody would test the system. So, for example, the gentleman in San Diego here, who's on the registry, I asked them to try an experiment. And the experiment was this: the wife went without him, and she was able to come onto the base and go to the exchange. Okay, that was an experiment I asked them to conduct. So isn't that interesting? The dependent of this person could get on base. We don't know if that was a mistake or what. So she's going to try it a couple more times just to make sure that's what's going on. So it might be possible that your spouse can get, or any of your dependents can get on base and you can't. I don't know. We really need, before we file a lawsuit, of course, we need to know more precisely what problem we're up against here. And I don't know, you know, again, we're talking, I'm so far, the people I've talked to have been denied access to go on a military campus, right? But I don't know what about the VA. I don't have any reports yet of anybody who is not being able to enter a VA facility.
Thank you.
You're certainly welcome. And folks, this is not the first time that a military issue has come to our attention. And in fact, I reached out about 6 months ago to a congressional committee that deals with veterans issues. And oh, by the way, they still haven't replied to that. And that had to do with, believe it or not, military cemeteries. And so at this point in time, if you're on the registry, this is my understanding, I still haven't seen the law. If you're on the registry, though, you can't be buried in a military cemetery. And I think that's wrong. I mean, if you served, I think honorably. I don't think you could be buried there if you have a dishonorable discharge. But if you served there in the military and stuff, that and you meet all the other qualifications, that you should be able to be buried there. And now this issue about being denied access to the base, you know, to military bases, and it brings up the question, right, in so many people's minds, what's next? And of course, I think the one thing most people have the greatest concern about is when, you know, are they going to stop paying me? Is my retirement income going to end? Folks, I don't mean to alarm anybody that nobody said that has happened yet, but it's this whole thing about a slippery slope. So first they say you can't be buried in a military cemetery. Then they say your live version of you can't go on a military base. The question is, it does beg the question, what's next?
It also has to do with the nature of the registry in the first place. Even if you take, you know, Smith versus Doe, you know, you've got to understand the premise of that. This is a mechanism for monitoring. Okay, it's not a mechanism for denying benefits. It's not a mechanism for imposing more punishment and so forth. And it's gotten so far out of hand that people, like anything else, you know, computers are misused, tools are misused. You know, you can't use a screwdriver as a hammer. But, you know, this is the nature of the beast. This is where we're really having some issues. And so whenever this tool is being misused, and it looks to me clearly like a denial of a benefit here, which was already earned previously, and it wouldn't really even matter to me, because if it's a denial of a benefit, you're misusing the tool. And so it's important to challenge these things at every juncture. That's my two cents.
Yeah, thank you, Chance. So again, folks, we are taking this extremely seriously. If you care about this issue, we hope that you'll make a donation to Axel. And as I said, there are two legal minds already working on this. This really is a civil issue and a criminal defense attorney, so he's not directly involved in this. But the gentleman that I have already met with now, he is a civilian attorney. He is on the East Coast. And so it'd be great if we had a 1-2 punch here, possibly with two lawsuits in the future. Okay, so Roger, before we move on to the topic of travel, let's take another call.
Bruce made a comment, and I'm 80%. I'm 80% disability served in the Army. Use the VA for medical. Will this affect me? And he said that you answered that question. So the next person is Dennis. So go ahead, Dennis, and unmute yourself.
Yes, I am a veteran, and about 3 years ago, I tried to get access to LA Air Force Base. To go to the commissary. I went through all the procedures to get access, but was denied. They wouldn't let me on the base because of me being on the registry. That's one issue. This was over 3 years ago, so this is an ongoing, in my mind, an ongoing problem. Secondly, I just had my yearly physical with the VA. I'm a disabled veteran, and I had no issues getting my physical at the VA facility clinic. I don't know about the getting on a base to get treatment. I haven't had to do that. Mm-hmm. But I appreciate you looking into this issue. I only wanted to get access to go to the commissary, and I was disappointed that issue even came up, but it did, and I hope that you were able to make some progress in getting that rectified.
Yeah, thank you so much. We appreciate that data point. And folks, that's what I'm doing right now, is I'm collecting data points like that gentleman who just spoke. And then at some point in time, we hope to have a clear picture. So as stated earlier, but bears repeating, I don't know what's going on with VA facilities. We have one gentleman who said he's not having a problem or hasn't had a problem yet. And that's great. I hope that continues that way. But we have had so many people contacting me during the past 2 weeks, telling me, sharing with me the fact that they've been denied access to one military facility or another. And quite frankly, that's, as I said earlier, unconscionable. And we are conducting legal research here to see what some possible legal claims are, and then whether or not we can or should proceed with one or more lawsuits. So please understand that we are very much engaged in, on this issue, and we're going to do something about it, even if the Congressional Committee does not. Okay, so let's move on to the next topic, which is travel. And I'm just going to open it up to both domestic and overseas travel because of the time. We want to make sure that we have 15, 20 minutes to address to this issue. And then after travel, for those of you from California and you're hanging in there, we'll talk about the tiered registry law right after we talk about travel. So, and I'm going to say in the meantime, if you can in some way or another, either through the chat room here or through any other way that you can think of, let us know what state you're from. If you're from a state outside of California, we're just, it's kind of like marketing to see how broad our message is traveling. So domestic travel, that's travel within the United States. And the issue here, quite frankly, is each state has their own requirement to about how long you can stay in their state without having to register. The extremes seem to be on one end, it seems to be Rhode Island, where if you go visit Rhode Island for even 24 hours, you have to register. The other extreme seems to be the state of Hawaii, and that's 10 days and a single visit, 30 days during the calendar year before you're required to register. So other states, Florida, it's 3 days, Las Vegas, I think it's 48 hours chance. Is that right? 48 hours?
I think it's 48 hours now.
Mm-hmm. So the reason we're telling you this, there's really, well, we're trying to help you navigate this minefield of laws, okay? And ignorance of the law is no excuse anywhere else, and it's not here in either. So you have to know about the laws of the state through which you travel. And if you violate the law, you could be charged with, convicted of failure to register. And in some states, that's its really stiff penalty. And in addition to that, you might end up registering in more than one state. And Chance, why don't you explain why that's a bad idea?
Yeah. You know, what if you have to register in another state, you may never come off the registry, which is really the basic premise. So let's just say that you went to Florida, you registered in Florida, came back home to California, got relief in California, and now you no longer have to register in California. You will remain permanently on the Florida registry for the rest of your life, and even after you pass away. So it's really important that you don't do that, because if you achieve relief, you're going to be in a really good position as a Californian. But if you're on another registry and it's a lifetime registry, you're going to be impacted just the same forever. So that's the bottom line there.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Chance. So so we're not discouraging you from traveling domestically, again, within the United States. What we're saying instead is to be careful. So it's to your advantage to not be required to register in multiple states. But folks, we understand sometimes you just have to do it. I know one person, it was because of a family member's funeral and, you know, the memorial service and all that, and just decided to bite the bullet and register in a second state. So it's your decision to make, but as Chance said, there's a significant downside if you do that. And, you know, one of the reasons, if nothing else, think about the International Megan's Law. And there's two basic requirements. The second one is that if you're required to register as a sex offender for an offense that involved a minor under age 18, then, you know, they can put a unique identifier in your passport. So think about this. If you're in California and you're lucky enough to get your petition granted and you're no longer required to register in California, but you're on the Florida registry, guess what? The federal government is still going to add a unique identifier to your passport. So that's what we're trying to help you avoid. Maybe if you don't care about the unique identifier, but most people do. The fact is, we're trying to help you, you know, successfully navigate. The other thing is about overseas travel. overseas travel can be very problematic. It's not just your passport, by the way, but also what countries will allow you to enter. I'm happy to report there are 26 countries in Europe that will allow you to enter. The four major countries are Italy, France, Germany, and Spain. So if you want to go to those four countries, they'll welcome you. They don't care. They know how ridiculous these sex offender laws are, and so they will allow you to enter. But there are many countries that will not allow you to enter. And right now, all of Asia is off limits with one exception, and that's Hong Kong. So don't go to Asia, folks. If you travel to Asia, if you're on the registry, you will be turned away. And there'll be no warning. They will let you purchase your ticket. They will let you get on the airplane. They will let you travel to that country. And it might take you 12, 15 hours to get there. And once you get there, they're going to say, nope, you can't enter our country. And what that means is you cannot leave the airport. So you might have loved ones or friends or anybody waiting for you. It's just too bad. They're not going to let you out of the airport. You want to add to that, Chance?
Well, it's no fun not being let out of the airport. And, you know, you'll be sent home. And that, you know, that's a humongous loss, especially of your money and your time. And so, you know, prepare and make sure that when you do travel, you know exactly where you're going to go and what the likely outcome is going to be.
Yes. And I had a client, this is a real life story. He is a U.S. citizen. His wife is a Japanese citizen. And so they went to Japan to go buy property in Japan. They're, you know, able to do that financially and wanted to buy a house in Japan. And when he got there, they would not let him out of the airport. And in fact, they kept him in the airport. He had to stay at a hotel. They had a guard standing outside of his hotel room. And the reason he was in the hotel room was he couldn't get a flight till the next day to return to the United States. So he never got out of the airport. He never got out of that hotel room except to go to the plane that took him back to the United States. It cost him a lot of time and it cost him a lot of money. And folks, you want to avoid that. So let me say one thing about the unique identifier, because it is a change in my recommendation. And that is if you plan to travel overseas and you don't have a unique identifier in your passport, and again, the people who are required to have a unique identifier are people whose offense involved a minor, and I'm sorry, but CP possession is included in that category, then you need to have a unique identifier in your passport. And in the past, I said, because some people were getting new passports and they didn't have the unique identifier in it, and I congratulated them. Now I say, nope, turn it back in, get a new passport, and make sure you have a unique identifier in it. If you're not planning to travel overseas, you just want the passport for domestic identification purposes, that's another matter. But if you're going to really go travel overseas with that passport, please make sure you have a unique identifier added to it. And I didn't know until just recently how to do that. And then I was educated on that topic. And so I passed it on to you online, but on our website rather, and now as well, which is you have to write a letter that goes in with your application for the new passport, basically saying, hey, I'm a covered sex offender. That's the term used in the international Megan's Law. And therefore I want not just a new passport, but I want a new passport with a unique identifier on it. Why would I even say that? What changed my thinking and my recommendation? Unfortunately, I had a client who he consulted with me ahead of time about going to Europe. And I said, hey, there's these 26 countries in Europe. He booked travel to go to one of those 26 countries with his wife. They went there. They were going there to celebrate their 30th wedding anniversary. And his bags were checked. And he and his wife were on the plane. And the Department of Homeland Security came on that plane before the flight took off, and they took him and his wife off that plane. So talk about embarrassment, humiliation, everything else. And according to Department of Homeland Security, they had notified him ahead of time that his passport had been revoked. He swears up and down, left and right to me and the others that he never got that notice, but that's the reason, the excuse maybe, that they took him off an airplane at LAX. that was bound for the Netherlands, to Amsterdam particularly, and they took him off that plane, and he could not, by the way, get a passport quickly enough to basically recover any of his travel. He had already planned, you know, already paid for 2 weeks of lodging in Europe, and he basically lost that money, as well as, of course, the plane tickets. So folks, we don't want that to happen to you. So my recommendation at this point, unfortunately, is apply for a new passport. Again, if you're in fact, you're going to travel overseas, and make sure you have a unique identifier in your passport. Chance, what do you think about that?
Well, what do I think is that if you don't need the passport, don't bother to do that. Certainly, if you get a notice, respond to it. I don't like that unique identifier at all. And I just don't like it, period.
I don't either. And, you know, when I challenged international Megan's Law, I said, this is like the scarlet letter right here in your passport. And oh, by the way, in the history of our planet, there are only two countries that have ever added a unique identifier to anybody's passport, whereas Nazi Germany, I'm not making this up, folks. I've seen the passports, right? And in Nazi Germany, they put a big red J on the passports of people who are of Jewish faith. And then the Russians did it later, again, signifying somebody was Jewish. So why in the world the United States of America would want to be members of that club still? It saddens me greatly, but that's what we're dealing with. So if anybody has a question about either domestic or international travel, this is the time. Again, you can raise your hand here on Zoom, or you can press star and the 9 key, and then you can ask a question or make a comment. Roger, Amy, do we have?
We do, Mike. Mike asks.
Yes, hello. I've got two questions. The first is, if you're in one EU country, don't you have free access pretty much to all the other countries that also belong to the EU? And the second question is, if the other country finds out that they don't want to admit you for whatever reason, aren't they the ones that have to pick up the tab for your return flight back? Thanks.
No. So
the answer to the second question is no, right, James?
No. And anybody who's ever traveled the EU will understand that every country, just because they say it's no border travel and all that, doesn't necessarily mean that they don't check visas and they don't check passports. Of course they do. Whenever you travel from place to place, you get checked. And you know, if the country's not going along with the program, you get dinged. And you know what? It's on you. So that you should know.
Yeah, I agree with Chance. Next question or comment?
There are none.
Okay, great. All right. So Chance and I have been talking about domestic and overseas travel for years now. Not that we're total experts in all of this, but just know that you need to be careful when you travel, either domestically or overseas. Do your homework ahead of time. By the way, we have on the AXEL website, oh, wonderful, resource. So if you go to the website and up toward the top of the page, there are some links. One of the links is the word legal. If you click on legal, and then there's a drop down menu, look there, and we've got a chart for the different states and what their registration requirements are for visitors. And then also, Roger, we also have now an international button. Is that correct?
Yeah, let's see. Under the we had listed the Schengen countries listed under there.
Okay, but there's a tab called.
See where you put it.
Right.
Sorry, you cut out there. What did you say?
Isn't there a button or a tab on our website with the word international?
There is. It goes news about us, laws, resources, FAQ, and get involved, living, Janice's journal, and then international travel. And under there are all the different references, including the Schengen nation.
Yeah. So so please go there, folks. Those gives you some basic information about domestic and international travel. That should be the beginning of your research. Don't rely completely on that information. Okay, so let's move on to the last big topic here, which is the tiered registry law. Folks, if you're not from California, you still might want to listen here because, as I said, we often set the tone, if not the law, for the rest of the country. And that is that other countries, other states rather, copy what California does. But we do have a tiered registry law with Senate Bill 384. Senate Bill 384 is not the tiered registry law that we asked for when we lobbied. We asked for a bill that was based on risk, current risk. But instead, we got a law that's based upon the offense for which you were convicted. And that's a huge difference. So I say that because there are many provisions of the tiered registry law with which I disagree. And I can pretty safely say Chance feels the same way about it. However, comma, we have to deal with what we have. Now, 3.5 years after this law was passed, the petitioning process under the tiered registry law began. So that's really, I think, the focus of today's discussion, because we've told you before what the three tiers are and what some other basic information. And so I think I'll just skip that and assume that you know the basic information. But we want to talk today really about some experiences people have had in filing petitions here in California for removal. So we have a three-tiered system. Nobody gets off the registry automatically in California. You have to file a petition. And if you're not on parole, you're not on probation, you're not on supervised release, you're not in custody, oh my goodness, all those things. And you qualify by duration of how long you've been registering, then in fact, you're going to submit your petition. So the bottom line is this, you submit the petition in the county where you currently live, not where you're convicted, but in the county in which you currently live. Now for some people, it's the same county, but for many people, there are different counties. We Americans like to move around, right? So submitting the petition, the first thing you have to figure out is where you submit your petition, you file your petition. And Chance and I have a webinar, a training that's on the AXSAW website. So it tells you step by step how to complete the petition, how to serve copies of the petition, et cetera. And so again, we're not going to repeat that information because it's available on the website, but what we do want to talk about is what experiences some people have been having. So here we are, it started on July 1. So here we are about 3.5 months into the petitioning process, and a few petitions have been granted, but unfortunately only a few. The superstar in the petitioning process appears to be San Diego County. And the reason I say that is that San Diego County got together the judges and the public defender's office and the DAs and also the local law enforcement. And they said, hey, let's create a system where we can efficiently and quickly process petitions. And so as far as I know, San Diego has the most petitions granted. But having said that, I think it's less than 10. So less than 10 in 3.5 months. I'm a little disappointed, quite frankly, in that number, but I'm going to tell you, I think it's more robust than any other place. I know Placer County up here in Northern California, they granted their first petition about 2 weeks ago. By the way, it was a registrant who submitted his own petition. He basically listened to the webinar and felt comfortable completing his own petition. Oh, by the way, he was a tier one. He was assigned to tier one. And that, I think, made things a lot easier for him as well. So there's been other experiences. I'm doing battle right now with Contra Costa County. I filed two petitions there. The DA's office is recommending one be summarily denied, the other one that there be a hearing on the merits. And one of those two men is a tier one offender. That makes absolutely no sense to me. The other one's a tier two, makes only a little bit more sense to me. but Chance, I know you've had a positive result, and I certainly would like you to share that with others.
Well, things are in general turning out positive in cases that I have filed. But one thing I think is worth mentioning is that in LA County, in San Fernando, about a couple of weeks ago, I had a to be determined granted. And initially, the DA's office was objecting, and they were their stance was that the DOJ is the one that designates these things, and they can't do anything without a designation. And what I had to do was communicate with them and explain to them that it's not the DOJ that designates tier level, but it's the law itself that designates tier level. DOJ just simply matches this information against what it has listed and reconfirms what that actually is. It doesn't do the heavy lifting, the law does. And once the DA's office, the supervisor there at the court understood that, she agreed. And not only did she agree, but the judge agreed. And we got that granted, and it was just awesome. And it was wonderful, and it didn't take a whole lot of time, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't complicated in terms of process. Other jurisdictions I'm dealing with may be a little bit more complicated in terms of process, and that is because every jurisdiction is different. You know, what I say by jurisdiction, what I mean by that is every county may do things a little bit differently. LA is kind of a fractured place. You know, it's not centralized like San Diego. And that's why Janice is saying that they get an A. They get an A for organization. We don't know where they're drawing the line in terms of what they're willing to grant and what they're not. And I'm interested in knowing whether or not any 288As have been granted in San Diego. I certainly have those coming up in other jurisdictions. And it would be interesting to map out exactly which jurisdictions are just going with what the law says exactly, or kind of parsing out, you know, these grants in terms of what's low level versus what they would consider high level. So we don't know that yet. We're kind of collecting information on that. But for organizational purposes, yes, San Diego centralized. I agree with Janice. They get an A. Los Angeles hasn't, and so it's kind of hit and miss on every jurisdiction. And by the way, enforcement agencies that you have to deal with before you even get to the court in terms of eligibility. So there's kind of like a weird dance going on there. But other than that, you know, it just started in July, and we are learning and accumulating information and sharing it amongst each other and you.
Yeah, thank you. And folks, if you have a question about the tiered registry law, please, this is the time. If you would, go ahead and press star and the 9 key if you're on the phone. And if you, in fact, are here on the Zoom with us, go ahead and raise your hand and Roger will call upon you. I'm happy that Chance is having positive experiences. I haven't had a positive experience yet. I'm still waiting. I have a hearing on Monday for one gentleman, and it involves Los Angeles. This will be our fourth hearing on a petition. He is a tier two, and the problem has not, the DA's office has already said they don't object to the petition. I thought that was going to be the difficult part, but instead it's the city, and the city hasn't done what they're supposed to do. And I mean, the law says cities, this is what you're supposed to do, local law enforcement, right? You're supposed to make a designation whether or not somebody's eligible to petition for removal. And it got so bad that, in fact, I went to an extreme and I filed a lawsuit, a writ of mandamus against that city to get them to make a tier designation. And lo and behold, I got the tier. Remember, my hearing is 8:30 on Monday morning. I got their tier designation information Friday at 4:00, and they made a mistake. And of course, the mistake is not in the favor of my client. So we're probably going to get another continuance. We're probably going to have 5 hearings on this petition. And I think eventually we'll be successful. And, you know, it's like, okay, patience, be patience, be patience. And I'm not going to take no for an answer. But at some point in time, we're wasting court resources, because each time there's a hearing, we're in front of a judge and we're doing all this dance. But I'm grateful that the LA District Attorney's Office seems to be acting reasonably, and they're not objecting to petitions. At least that should not be objected to. So so folks, I will, one thing I want to remind people, you really do have to wait until the month, well, actually until your birthday. That's the new birthday rule, right? You have to wait until your birthday to submit your petition. If you don't wait till your birthday, your petition will be rejected. And, you know, it's not on the merits, but it's still a rejection, and you're going to have to redo it anyway. So why not just wait until your birthday or later to submit your petition? And please know that, too, it's not that it's not that you're going to be in trouble and you can't submit a petition if you wait past your birthday. Not at all. It's just you have to wait. That's the earliest date on which you can submit your petition. Okay. Or an attorney can do it on your behalf. So I did mention that there was a registrar in Placer County who submitted his own petition and he was successful. I'm so happy for him. But there are people who just may not have that capability. Or I've talked to a lot of people who, quite frankly, have PTSD, don't want to deal with the court ever again in their entire lives. And they much rather have an attorney like Chance or myself, or there are some other attorneys out there who can do this. And so we are available to do it. I'm still taking clients. Chance, I assume you're still taking clients as well for the petition.
I am.
So,
and I would mention one thing too.
Sure.
If you're not going to do it yourself and you're going to go to an attorney, it would be good if you had your tier designation letter or you knew what your tier designation was. Two, if you have proof of current registration, which means you just registered on your birthday and you ask them to give you proof of current registration, which is a form that's provided to them so you can use it to attach it to your petition. And it would be nice if you had a live scan that would help your attorney out. And also any risk assessments that you may have had done prior to this would be helpful in terms of your attorney being able to understand the facts and circumstances of your case. So just to mention that real briefly.
Yeah, thank you for that, Chance. So Roger, at this point in time, do we have any questions or comments?
Don, go ahead.
Hi again. My question deals with El Dorado County. Have either of you had any experience one way or the other with El Dorado County?
Absolutely.
You're smiling. I hope that's good.
Well, yes and no, but go ahead with your question.
Well, my question is, what's the experience been? Have they been summarily denying? Are they giving you problems, throwing out roadblocks? Because I'm considering if they do, or if they're denying more than they're granting, and maybe it'd be good to know the reasons for the denial, I could certainly move to San Diego County where my daughter lives and move in with her for 6 months to establish residency and apply down there. Because I think you get on a 5-year wait list, don't you, if you get denied?
Okay, so the answer is El Dorado is a tough county. Mm-hmm. And no, I don't have any petitions there currently, but I have dealt with El Dorado in terms of other things, post-conviction relief. If you have a chance to live in San Diego, you don't have to wait 6 months. All you have to do is, move to San Diego. But as between the two counties, I take San Diego any day. What do you think, Janice?
I agree with you, Chance, that right now San Diego is the most organized and efficient at processing these petitions. And so if you have an opportunity to move there, then please do so. You and everybody else who's listening to this, in the beginning, I thought Los Angeles was going to be the best place. But L.A., at this point in time, as far as I'm concerned, gets a failing mark as far as the petitioning process. And I say that not because of the deputy, not because of the DA's office, as I said, and it bears repeating, that the L.A. district attorney appears to, if not being helpful, at least being neutral and not objecting to petitions. And that's great. But the problem is that they are farming these petitions out to courtrooms all over the county. And so you don't have a dedicated team who's used to working with petitions. And so, Chance was successful there in the one San Fernando office, I think you said.
Yes, San Fernando. Now, I'm not sure if that would have played well in Norwalk.
Right.
Or in other branches. And this is the problem, and you're bringing this out right now, which is that there may be a great deal of inconsistency.
There absolutely are a lot of inconsistencies. I do have a couple of petitions pending right now in San Francisco, the city actually, and they've come up with their own, I think, a very convoluted process. They hand you some pink ID processing card, and you have to go through this process to prove that you are the person. Now, why would anybody else show up for you in court? I don't know. But anyway, it's like, well, if they have an itch, let's scratch it and get it done. And I think, and the DA's office in San Francisco is not objecting to the petitions. And so that's good news. So we're running through, you know, some speed bumps here. It's a new process for everybody. And I think that a lot of the kinks are going to be ironed out. But I encourage people to go ahead and submit your petitions anyway. Get in the queue here. You know, things are going to be smoothed out. And maybe there are going to be a couple of contrary counties like Contra Costa. But I think eventually even in those counties will ultimately be successful because, you know, part of it is they've got to become comfortable with this process. And we'll see. So far, I don't have any hearings scheduled yet on the merits, though Contra Costa County is probably going to be my first one. And folks, you know, even though Chance and I say in the webinar and I will say today, you know, you may or may not be able to submit your own petition, file your petition with the court. But if you are scheduled for a hearing on the merits, please get legal counsel. You will be shredded by the district attorney's office if you show up in court without a legal attorney on a hearing on the merits. They will say things that are not true. Chance and I both had those experiences where the DA's office say things that are just made up, and you could end up sputtering. On the other hand, if you have a counsel, your counsel is prepared. Of course, Chance and I will be prepared. The fact is that we can negate the things that the district attorney says, and you just might be flustered in the moment. And I think there's a saying out there, Chance, something about the somebody who represents himself in court, I don't know, is basically doing themselves a disservice. Even if you're a lawyer, by the way, lawyers need to hire lawyers to handle their legal matters because it's personal, you know, it becomes personal. And certainly this opportunity to get removed from the registry, I mean, this is such a fabulous opportunity. And I'm so happy to work on petition cases because I feel like I'm helping people escape the plantation, quite frankly. Let's cut the chains off your legs here and, you know, let you get to freedom, because once you're off the registry, your life will change dramatically. So I'm happy to work.
One thing too to remember, I think this is really important. Everybody wants the tier system to work perfect and work now. Look, the last remedy was certificates of rehabilitation. And even up until its last day, it had trouble working and everybody had to understand it each and every time it went through when there were issues, and it never quite worked right. Never quite worked right. Did it work? Yeah, it worked, but you know, it was problematic. And that thing had been around forever. Now we're just starting the tiered system. We really are just getting we're just trickling in kind of some results. We really don't know exactly comprehensively how it's all working. And there are a lot of adjustments to be made. It's going to take a while. And we're just going to have to do it inch by inch. So, you know, be patient. And as Janice says, don't be afraid of it. You know, go forward.
The other alternative I have is possibly moving to Alameda County. And I believe they were one of the strong proponents of this law when it was coming through. Contra Costa's right next door. I'm surprised that they're giving you as many problems as they are. Any word on Alameda County and success or lack thereof?
I have no Alameda County, but I guess like you, I'm surprised, but certainly not shocked that Contra Costa is being hostile. That's how I view it anyway, with these first two petitions that I filed there. But think about it. I mean, I think about the difference between Orange County and Los Angeles County, and they're adjacent counties, and yet they couldn't be more different.
Would it be possible to ask the audience that's here, to anybody who's petitioned in El Dorado County and has not contacted either of you two, to raise their hand so I have an idea as to how many have at least given a try?
Sure. Yeah. So in case anybody didn't hear that, I'm repeating what I think you just said, which is if anybody has in fact already submitted a petition either on their own or through counsel in El Dorado County, would you please raise your hand and we'll do our best to get to you. Or you can make a comment in the chat room, or if you're on the phone, press star and the 9 key, please. We got 3 options there. Okay, let's go ahead and move on to the next call or comment. You're welcome.
Hey, Rafael, go ahead. And it would work best if people just put it in the chat window, please.
Thank you. I had a question in regards to tier assignment review requests. I know that the submission is to do on the birthday date. I don't know about the request for a review, but I went through the certificate of rehabilitation hearing, and at the time there was an issue where they were confusing me with a predator status because of multiple samples of abuse, which were only added as a reference to my character. They were never charged offenses nor convictions. Ultimately, I was only convicted of one count of date rape on an adult. But within the documents that are exposed on the internet, it shows four different other cases that are categorized to me as an offenses, even though I had never been convicted of those, nor even been contacted at the time by the police on those cases, but they were added on my conviction of the one case on a two charge on the same conviction. Mm-hmm. So the other thing is that
let's stop there because you ask an important question. I want to give you an answer to that. And so other people who are watching this or listening to this in real time, plus the people who listen to the recording later, will know that your profile on the Megan's Law website should only reflect convictions, not charges, but convictions. If you think your profile on the Megan's Law website is incorrect or incomplete, please contact me at 805-896-7854, 805-896-7854, or by email at jmarybellucci@aol.com. So by the way, you should not be looking at your own profile. And I'm just assuming this caller has not looked at his own profile, but somebody else looked at it for him. And I can do that for you as well. And I can even print out a copy of your profile and send it to you and without violating the law. So it is important to have that information on your profile correct. So I just wanted to answer that question or comment on that, sir. And please, if you have another comment or question, please go on.
Janice, before we move on, perhaps we can, I think I know where this is going, but let me just say this too. For purposes of the tiered system, when they look at your criminal background, they run your federal and your state. And then they process it so that the only things that are really being tallied up is your underlying conviction, any other sex crimes that you've been convicted of, and any failures to register. That's it. And if you suffered no conviction and it's only one count for one case, that's what should be reflected. And if you have no failures to register, then there will be zero. And that will be the only thing that appears on the CISAR printout in terms of eligibility, just so that you know.
Thank you so much. Yeah, the outlining questions to me is that we said that level three is for heavy crimes or repeat offenders or this and that. But in my case, we fought the lack of force, the use of force, because it was an inebriated situation where apparently she couldn't resist because being inebriated. I still got convicted even though there was no defense. But I'm never been aggressive, and I got 32 years of clean after my certificate of rehabilitation, yet I'm still on level three. So I question that, and I'd like to have a review since I believe that this got to be some improvement there after proving over 35 years that I never repeated that problem. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome. Unfortunately, folks, the amount of time you spend on the registry does not affect what tier you're going to be assigned to. I said it earlier, and it bears repeating, which is that the tier assignments in general are based upon the conviction of the offense for which you were convicted. So you could be, and Chance has said it and earlier, it does bear repeating as well, that we have people who are convicted of misdemeanors right now being assigned to tier three. It's wrong. It's wrong. Okay. There were political compromises that were made back in 2017 to keep this bill alive, to turn it into a law. And so that's why there are some very, I was going to say unusual. I don't know. There's just some mistakes that were made and some decisions that were made that were not based upon facts or reason or logic. So perhaps, sir, you were caught up in that net. I don't know. But please feel free to contact me during the work week or Chance, and we can go over your details with you. But I will say about the profiles on the Megan Saul website that only the offenses for which you were convicted, not the offenses for which you were charged with, should be listed on the Megan Saul website. And I think that's it. Roger, do we have any more questions or callers?
We do. It's kind of a long one here. Stan, I didn't understand the first chunk of it, so you have to retype it, but the rest of it seems to involve our collaboration, Axel collaborating with other groups. He mentions that's about FACE, Common Defense, Veterans for Peace, ACLU, MI, trans LGBT groups, Jewish allies. I'm shortening it down, but he's got a long list about it.
Okay. Well, I think the general gist of the question is that about Axel reaching out to other organizations. We do it on a regular basis. So let me just mention ACLU as one of those. We've had the door slammed in our face so much with ACLU that I don't care. I have a pretty tough personality. I'll go back to ACLU again. I'm considering doing that here on this issue involving the military retirees because maybe it's generic enough that they can get involved in it. And also, I think it makes a lot of sense to go to veterans. Hopefully there will be a veterans group out there that's not scared away by the fact that this has something to do with people on the registry. I can't tell you for sure, but for the military issue, it's premature for us to reach out to the other organizations. Having said that, I get back to the issue about the proposed SORNA regulations, and we did a really good job, Axel, and patting Chance and I on the back, and others too, our members of our board of directors, in that we reached out to other organizations. We said, look, this is a nationwide problem. We need you to directly communicate with your members and ask them to do these three things. Make a phone call, send an email, and mail a letter. Three things, right? 1 hour's worth of your time to prevent what will be quite possibly mass chaos and lots of harm inflicted upon registrants and their family members. So it's not that we are stopping where we are in our track, but I hear what you're saying, which is to reach out to allied organizations. It's a great idea, and we continue to do it. The folks who are listening, watching this, please understand you can help us do that as well. So like if you're very active in a veterans group or something like that, contact me, contact Chance, let us know. And then we can go to the people that are your contacts instead of having to make a cold call. So thank you for that idea. I like it a lot. Any more callers, Roger?
No, that's it.
Excellent. Okay. I want to mention a couple of other things that Axel is involved in, and then both Chance and I will say our farewells here. One is that we have a case that we are challenging a state law that basically said that most felons, except for sex offenders, can in fact serve on a jury. It was a terrible decision that was made to add that exclusion at the very last step in the legislative process, but that's what happened. So we lost the demur on that case, and we're appealing the demur. In fact, that appeal was filed just yesterday on November 19th. I feel very good about that. So we'll keep posting everybody about that, but it's just one small example, quite frankly, of what we call but-for laws. So like in California, Proposition 47 passed, and it basically said, oh, well, now we're going to have a shoplifting law. And so anybody who is convicted of basically stealing something worth less than $950, it's shoplifting and it's not theft, made a huge difference in the penalties. In fact, it made it a misdemeanor instead of a felony. And then at the last minute, they said, oh, unless you're on the sex offender registry, right? So does it really make any difference if you're on the registry, if you steal something worth $750? Shouldn't that be a misdemeanor regardless of whether or not you're on the registry or not? So this juror's exclusion, and it's another example of a but-for law. So we are actively litigating that. And another thing that we're litigating has to do with the Department of Corrections here. Once again, they've issued regulations that are inconsistent with the laws that created this new benefit. It has to do with resentencing opportunities. And if you might remember the work we did on Proposition 57, which ended up with a positive, unanimous decision in our favor at the state Supreme Court, you know, this is just the beginning for our litigation about these resentencing opportunities. And I do predict that we will be ultimately successful, but CDCR is making us go through the steps. And the one reason that I feel a little bit better about it is that ultimately they end up paying the organization for suing them. That always makes me feel good. Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground today. I really thank everybody for hanging in there with us, especially with the technical difficulties we experienced first thing this morning. I do apologize for that, but technology doesn't always work, or maybe with technology operators, we don't always work it properly. But again, thank you for sticking with us today. I want to remind people there's a $2,500 matching grant out there for anybody who's interested in this issue about registrants having access to military bases. We will announce that on the website as well. And lastly, I want to wish you all a great Thanksgiving holiday. Be safe, and I hope you have a peaceful time.
Happy Thanksgiving. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you, everybody. Take care. Bye-bye.